Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. William Gibson made his reputation in what was once the future as a sci-fi pioneer who famously coined the term cyberspace before the web even existed. His latest novel, Zero History, is the third in a trilogy exploring a dystopic present day, which is caught up with that future, and then some. Hackers, spies, and bare-knuckled corporations grapple in a shadowy world in the thrall of objects and technology, private drones, and rare denim. This hour on Point, William Gibson on his new novel and our new age. You can join the conversation. Was William Gibson once your guide to the future? Has he become your guide to the here and now? Have you read him since Neuromancer, Burning Chrome? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Seattle is author William Gibson, a science fiction visionary. His debut novel, Neuromancer, was the first to win all three major science fiction awards, the Nebula, the Hugo, and the Philip K. Dick Award, back in 1985. His latest novel, out this week, is Zero History. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. William Gibson, welcome back to On Point. It's great to have you.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be back.
And here you are again, and you must feel sometimes locked in association with the digital realm. But wow, this book is all about the very, very, very tactile and a lot of physical.
Well, the digital, as I said recently somewhere else, has colonized the physical in large part. I think that's what the current issue of Wired magazine means by having death of the internet on the cover. It's not that the internet's going away, but it's stopped being a separate realm that we can only access through one particular window.
So what do you mean when you say the digital has colonized the physical?
Well, when I started to write about imaginary futures with very evolved versions of the internet, mm-hmm. the real internet was a specific territory that could only be accessed with what was then fairly special equipment. And there was a learning curve mm-hmm. that I myself never mastered.
It was the geek's realm, and theirs alone.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, the geek realm. And the geek realm was mysterious and vast and deep, mm-hmm. and all of those things were great for science fiction. But today, the technology is evolving in a way that turns that the geek realm inside out. And we now live within the geek realm through a very, very varied assortment of technologies. Is GPS cyberspace or physical space?
Yeah.
It's the cyberspace of physical space. And increasingly, we're all in GPS space all the time, whether we want to be or not. That's probably one of the easiest examples. But it is a very complex fabric of emerging technologies that have emerged from cyberspace. And that's becoming where we live. It's becoming impossible, I think, to separate the totality of that from what we think of as the world.
I can't think of a better example than GPS if you want to talk about the digital colonizing the physical. I mean, it tells us, you know, it locates us in the physical now. Yet I found myself reading this new book, Zero History, wondering about your personal response to all that, because there's plenty of digital in here. I mean, you've got sort of the equivalent of penguin-shaped private drones tracking people around and all kinds of technology that doesn't seem so futuristic at all in our age of drones. But then you, all through this, seem almost in the thrall of the physical, the arcane physical, the wonderful physical. I mean, you're writing about, you know, H.G. Wells' time machine-shaped showers that people are showering in, or the musky pong of indigo. Has your, I don't know, association with the digital realm sent you running back to the very material?
Not that I'm aware of, but it, you know, it may have to some extent. What I suspect is going on in what you've noticed in the book is that the juxtaposition of the digital and the physical, I found to be revealing, or potentially revealing, to have them side by side and creating a meaning that's contextual, not necessarily a meaning that I could boil down to a sentence or a phrase.
But the first, I don't know, 50-100 pages of this book are so jam-crammed with exotic, peculiar, marvelous physical objects. I began to wonder if you, you know, I mean, what is your house like? Do you have crazy, wild stuff all over the place?
Not so much. My house is relatively unlike that. The environment at the beginning of the book. I think the way that works, the way the opening environment of the book works for me is that the book starts in a really pronounced and very historical version of the pre-digital world.
Lots of taxidermy around, and
yeah, this taxidermy, because and some of that taxidermy is so old that probably the people who made it didn't have access to photography.
And the central kind of undertaking here is a sort of continent straddling search hunt for very particular material objects and artifacts of fashion.
Yeah, fashion in a sense. You know, artifacts of anti-fashion, possibly.
Yeah. Denim. I mean, I hadn't caught up with this entirely, but here you're discussing the finer points of particular weaves of denim and gussets and the box of blue jeans. you're way out in that territory.
Well, I think that one of the best examples of our movement, say America's movement into the future that's now our present, is what happened to the American denim industry vis-a-vis the Japanese denim industry. Denim, America really had denim down. It made the best denim in the world, and it had invented blue jeans. So around 1965, American jeans were as good as they were ever going to get, really as good as pretty much anybody was ever going to be able to get standard American five-pocket blue jeans. Sometime after that, I'm not sure when, but probably in the early 70s, A decision was made to go to wider looms in the factories that would produce more fabric more cheaply.
Mm-hmm.
And to the traditional American industrial denim looms, I think the fabric was about 6 feet wide. And so the old looms were being tossed out, and at all the factories, they were going to go for scrap. Suddenly, there were these polite Japanese gentlemen there saying, "May we buy that from you?
What you're throwing out there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'd love to have that." And people said, "Sure, take them. We're going to have to pay to take them away." And the Japanese took them back, took them apart, had them repaired by watchmakers, probably, and are still using them today. The Japanese are the only people in the world who can make American denim circa 1965. Actually, that isn't true, and I'll probably have angry emails from some American denim manufacturers.
But they got a bunch of the looms, and they made them beloved manufacturing pieces.
Yeah, because the Japanese came out of losing a war to us and being occupied by us with a profound and paradoxical admiration and nostalgia for our physical culture of another day.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with cyber sci-fi pioneer William Gibson about our culture now and his latest novel, Zero History. He joins us from Seattle, and you're welcome to join us as well. Is this your technology/cultural visionary? What's your question for William Gibson on the way we live, perceive, relate now? And has Gibson helped shape the way you see the world since the web? Was he way ahead of the news on how the digital era would shape us? Zero History is the new book. And William Gibson, I wonder if you'd read a little bit for us there. You talk about the semiotics of mass-produced American clothing in this book, with a particular eye toward military clothing.
Yeah. You know, this is Zero History's take on American military clothing. Mm-hmm. Military contracting was essentially recession proof, according to Big End, and particularly so in America. That was a part of it, and perhaps even the core of it, recession proofing. And Big End seemed centered on one area of military contracting, the one in which, Milgram supposed, Blue Ant's strategic skill set was most applicable. Blue Ant was learning everything it could, and very quickly, about the contracting, design, and manufacture of military clothing, which seemed, from what Milgram had seen so far, to be a very lively business. And Milgram, for whatever reason, or lack of one, was along for the ride. That was what Myrtle Beach had been about. Volunteer armies, the French girl had said, the one who'd worn the plaid kilt at yesterday's meeting in an earlier PowerPoint presentation that Milgram had found quite interesting, required volunteers, the bulk of them young men, who might otherwise be, for instance, skateboarding, or at least wearing clothing suggestive of skateboarding. And male streetwear generally, over the past 50 years or so, she said, had been more heavily influenced by the design of military clothing than by anything else. The bulk of the underlying design code of the 21st century's male street was the code of the previous mid-century's military wear, most of it American. The rest of it was workwear, most of that American as well, whose manufacture had co-evolved with the manufacture of military clothing, sharing elements of the same design code and team sportswear.
William Gibson, reading from his new novel, Zero History, and the semiotics of American clothing come into play here. Is this your observation outside the book as well? Are we all sort of prisoners of military styling?
Well, it's my observation. It's my observation of the opinion of contemporary clothing designers who, to a man or a woman, know that that's what's going on. It's not. I don't find it sinister or problematic at all. I just find it interesting. It has, in large part, to do with a very, very expensive kind of functionality that could be designed into military garments because the military could afford to spend any amount of money to get clothing that actually worked. And they also had to perfect proportional sizing, which is the proportional sizing of clothing is something we take absolutely for granted in our lives today, and it's an American invention from World War I.
Functionality in that clothing, but of course that also produces style. In many years now that we've had wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, you can scarcely go to an airport without seeing, you know, military guys in their camo and boots striding, you know, toward a gate somewhere. I mean, it is in our midst. Do you see it? And you clearly do see it in our fashion as well.
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be five or 10 years before the semiotics of Iraq era American military clothing percolates fully into the gap. Say, it takes a while, but I think it will probably happen.
But cargo pants and a lot clearly they're already in plenty of camo around. In this book, it seems that one of the things that the characters you're fonder of, perhaps, all want to do is escape fashion. They want to achieve some kind of atemporality, as you describe it. They want to get out of the flow of what everyone is perhaps prisoner of.
Well, I don't blame them in that, and I tend to applaud them in that. Fashion is not a word that I use very comfortably because it makes me think of Oscar Wilde's dictum that fashion is something so hideously ugly that it must be changed every 6 months. And so it's that fashion in that sense is the very paradigm of pointless obsolescence. And it leads to, you know, shoddy goods for the most part. So I've never been a fan of that, but I've always been very interested in all sorts of design generally, and maybe particularly so in the design of functional, long wearing, simple clothing, which is that was. Dominance in that was part of the American century. That was something that the United States learned to do better than anybody else for a while.
We're at 1-800-423-8255 with novelist William Gibson, who knew back in the cyber day that clothing design would be another great interest. And it's right at the heart, along with a lot of technology and pretty great dynamics in his new book, Zero History. 800-423-TALK. William Gibson joins us from Seattle, Washington. Let's go to our listeners, if I may. Creskill, New Jersey. Mike, you're on the air with William Gibson.
Hi, Tom and Mr. Gibson. I had a very quick question. Your earlier writings, you prognosticated, you know, very, very wisely, I guess, about the end of the empire for the U.S., so to speak. And I was just curious. You always seem to have these characters that yearn for nostalgia. It's always this balance between technology and the past. And I was just curious if maybe you could point to some optimism where you see the future, you know, for at least for the U.S., maybe harking back to a different era. You know, technology seems to be the theme, but deeper than that, I think you're going much deeper into much deeper waters there.
William Gibson?
Well, part of, I think in a way, part of zero history in a way is partly a kind of love letter to younger people. And a lot of those younger people are Americans or North Americans. And I picked up the whole idea in the book of people becoming obsessed with making things well again, making like really genuine, solid things again. I picked up on that from the contemporary culture of younger people, and I find that an optimistic thing. I don't actually think of it as nostalgia, though. I've long been convinced that nostalgia itself is somehow fundamentally an unhealthy modality. I don't think I'm not interested in a longing for the imagined values of the past, but in a longing for the capacity to make honest things. I mean, I'm actually sounding sort of like William Morris's arts and crafts movement, which isn't exactly my thing, but there may be some echo of that.
But I can see how our caller imagines there might be nostalgia. I mean, the worlds you've created are so often so dystopic, such dystopias, that I suppose readers imagine that you must be contrasting that to some image in your mind, at least, of something better.
Well, when I wrote Neuromancer, I thought I was committing an act of ludicrous optimism, because when I wrote Neuromancer, most informed and intelligent people expected the world to end in mutually assured Soviet American destruction.
Nuclear
destruction at any moment, literally. So by not setting my first novel in a post-Holocaust nuclear wasteland, I thought, well, you know, this is wild optimism considering what we know. And dystopia, I kind of distrust. Dystopia is really misused, because dystopia is a pure theoretical state, the opposite of utopia. We'll never have utopia, and we'll never have dystopia either. We always wind up with something that's relative. And I've said from the beginning of my career that Africa, for instance, is full of people who would happily immigrate to any of my imaginary futures at the drop of a hat, and they'd be better off. So it's, you know, my imaginary futures were really bad news for people who were relatively comfortable in the present, but they weren't bad news for people in that same present who were worse off than the people I was writing about in the supposed dystopian environment.
I wonder where that puts you then in the whole environmental debate, how you look at the green movement or the whole debate over climate change. It almost sounds, as you say, that you see, you know, humanity is always adjusting to things that might look bad at one moment and look manageable once you have to live in them.
Well, one of the once we have to, yes, that's true in a sense. We we're incapable of grasping, I suspect, the extent to which the world we live in today would be regarded as a dystopian nightmare by, say, our great-grandparents, a dystopian social and environmental nightmare from the point of view of our, well, great-grandparents.
But does that mean, okay, fine, bring on global warming?
No, it doesn't. I'm one of the... I don't actually see myself as being much at all in the business of prognostication, but one prediction I'd be willing to make is that our great-great-grandchildren will regard us with a degree of contempt, possibly unequaled in human history, because they'll be able to see that we knew in large part what we were doing and we didn't manage to do anything about it in time. And, you know, betcha, that's going to happen.
There's a little uncomfortable prognostication from a writer who says doesn't do it. Sylvia in Barton, Vermont. Sylvia, you're on the air.
Yes, I think I'm just calling with a note of just to say thank you. I didn't know about Mr. Gibson, and I believe that actually listening that I'm going to have a connection to a sane way to see the history of my own life. I'm 65. I grew up across the street from the last vertical textile mill in the United States, I believe. That is to say, the last textile mill that took cotton balls and turned out Levi Strauss denim.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was still young and moved back home to Milltown and saw the old looms rusting through the winters in the parking lots next to my grandmother's house. My mother worked for the textile mill until she died. It was, I knew that there was something, and I've known all these years, beyond simple nostalgia, which I also didn't trust as a touchstone.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, it is an amazing thing to hear someone of his repute and recognition, whom I will read now, everything he wrote, explain that was seeing those looms rusting. I suppose ours weren't bought by the Japanese, was indeed a critical moment in history, as I thought maybe it was.
Wow.
I just am calling to say thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sylvia. I appreciate that very much.
It's kind of a firsthand witness to what, in a way, you're describing or moving on from in Zero History, William Gibson. Oh, Sylvia,
well,
thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Sylvia. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. So we'll exempt you from nostalgia, and yet you're looking back and you're looking out right now. I saw you saying somewhere recently that you don't even see a future anymore in a way, that we're there.
Well, I don't see a capital F future in the way that there was a capital F future when I was a kid in the 50s.
Buck Rogers.
Yeah, the era of Buck Rogers Detroit.
Big Fins and Jetsons maybe a little later in their bubbles. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with cyber sci-fi pioneer William Gibson about our culture now and his latest novel, Zero History. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's get a call from New York City. Marlon, you're on the air with William Gibson.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Gibson, it's fascinating. I'm glad it's so just ironic and coincidental. I'm working on a great project I call The Next It, as in short for The Next Iteration of Human Existence, but it has a lot to do with this whole post-human future that's being talked about a lot amongst the futurist junkies. And what's your opinion on the existence of the whole social construct of race as we move to a faster, stronger, smarter human being that's in some ways created that will, in fact, probably reproduce a faster, stronger, smarter human being.
That's actually a good question. It's a really good question, and it's one that I've never run through my particular mill. I'm not the kind of writer who sits around having ideas and thinking about them and developing them and then writing books to illustrate them. I write books in order to have ideas. And so I would have to find myself in a narrative where your question or something very like it would arise, and then I would have to let the novel as laboratory run the tapes on where that would seem to go. I mean, the only idea I've got about that is that race probably won't mean the same thing to us in some very the same probably won't mean the same thing in the future that it's meant to us culturally.
Do you anticipate something like what Marlon's describing? I don't know, a bio-enhanced strain of humans that may be seen as a new race?
Well, we're already bio-enhanced to a remarkable degree. Through technology, we tend to have our own teeth longer and live longer and be bigger and stronger than people previously were. We're not the human beings in the wild that we once were. We've become something quite different, and there's abundant evidence that we're in the process of becoming something even more different. We're the first species to have decoded our own evolutionary information and started to edit it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's going to be big one way or another.
We're talking in the week that will come up to yet another anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Marlon calls from New York, and it makes me think about those. You've described those as an experience out of culture, the true beginning of the 21st century. And I don't know, you go on, Wikipedia, look at William Gibson. They have you describing it as the kickoff for a resurgent tribalism and the infantilization of society. I'm not sure when you might have said that. Do you still see it that way?
Yeah. The tendency is that both those tendencies are very strong, and both those tendencies are always with us, and I say us as human beings.
Tribalism. But infantilization, isn't that dangerous historically?
So is tribalism.
Well, sure.
In my view.
But one tribe might at least win, whereas if we're infantilized, can anybody win? Whatever that means.
Well, I think that's kind of hard to say. There are situations in which the more infantilized of the two opponents will win.
Will win because?
Just because they're too crazy to stop. They're too crazy to stop doing whatever it is. Whatever it is they're doing in the doctrine of asymmetrical warfare, mm-hmm. which is a really really important doctrine for all of us these days, because increasingly that all war is seems to be asymmetrical in a way that it wasn't 75 years ago. In the doctrine of asymmetrical warfare, if you're the little guy, what you need to get the big guy to do is to infantilize himself. You need to get the big guy to lose it and come after you in ways that will ultimately damage him, because that's really the only way you, as the little guy, can damage him, is to get him to do it himself. So you have to inflict, as the little guy, you have to inflict stinging symbolic damage on the big guy and get him to regress to the point that he starts doing incredibly stupid things strategically. And then, as the little guy, you're in the win position.
Are you talking about Iraq, about Afghanistan?
No, I'm just talking about the doctrine, the doctrines of asymmetrical warfare. That's what I think. What I just said is actually quite a good little potted description of how asymmetrical warfare always works, not just in America's responses to 9/11. It works that way in every situation historically that I've ever looked at. You get the little guy gets the big guy to injure himself.
In your new book, In Zero History, there's a kind of, at least will be read by many as an echo of the Afghan theater, at least, and I suppose Iraq too, but we've all learned a lot about drones in recent years. You've got them sort of penguin-sized, floating around London at the command, I guess, of your Hubertus Biggin, this overly wealthy, as you describe him, dangerously curious fiddler with the world's hidden architectures. What is that the next thing? Are we going to see kind of a mini dirigibles following us around, keeping track of us, not just in the skies over Afghanistan and Pakistan?
We won't, unfortunately, see the beautiful and charming Festo air penguins.
Festo air penguin.
Which are, you know, you can Google them. Look for them on YouTube. They're fabulous.
They actually exist?
Oh yes, and they're really only in the book because I love them so much after having seen them on YouTube.
You say charming, but they would make me paranoid if there was one floating above my car behind my house with a camera.
Well, yeah, it would. It would be a pretty unlikely platform for camera surveillance, but for camera, you know, that sort of camera surveillance I'm describing is going to be available in every electronics retailer in the world in pretty short order. You can already buy little area camera platforms that can be controlled through your iPhone for $300 or $400. So, and these they're already available. It's an interesting little invention that's going to completely change the world.
Democratizing surveillance.
Well, one way it's going to change it is that people who live on the 43rd floor of glass apartment towers are used to assuming they have a certain degree of privacy. But with the advent of the hobbyist aerial video drone, they don't have any privacy anymore because someone standing on the sidewalk can send the drone straight up to their floor and check out all the windows from about 3 feet back from the window. And you'll never even notice the drone because it's about the size of a dinner plate and mostly made of black styrofoam.
What a bummer for the summer shower. You know, yeah. Windows open and free.
Yeah, and it's actually, there's a part of our privacy just vanished with the invention of those things, but it's not Big Brother, it's the neighborhood peeping Tom.
Wow. Let's go to David in Andover, Massachusetts. David, you're on the air with William Gibson.
Hi, two quick questions, huge fan.
do you ever consider writing nonfiction about any of your interests, or I thought in particular of fashion, where, you know, Bruce Sterling and Neal Stephenson have sounded off on certain other areas nonfiction-wise? And then the other question is, I was thinking of, in response to Marlon's question, of Count Zero, where you have the Voodoo connection there, you know, and that kind of via where you're tapping into higher power, and black people figured in there. So
Voodoo as sort of as in voodoo.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
William Gibson, thanks, David.
Nonfiction, not so much. If I ever did write nonfiction, it would be so witheringly and obsessively specialized that I'd have, I think, maybe 300 readers
and an unhappy publisher.
Yeah, and unless it was, you know, one of those specialist web-based publishers, then we could sell 300 copies. I like the business of the Loa in inhabiting cyberspace in Count Zero. What I liked about it was the ambivalence that some of the characters themselves and the novel and its narrative voice take to whether or not there's any supernatural element to what's happening, whether or not these things that are manifesting in cyberspace might have anything to do with anything that anyone could ever have accessed prior to the advent of artificial intelligence. So my pleasure in it is in the ambiguity. It becomes bizarrely agnostic in a way that amuses me.
Gary in Keswick, Virginia. Gary, you're on with William Gibson.
Hello there. I'd just like to find out, Mr. Gibson, your perspectives, I guess, on the American culture of frontierism and how that would fit into, you know, the future and what we have looking forward to us.
Well, thank you. That's a really good thing for me to get into, because it's become kind of a theme for me. I think that the capital F future that I mentioned before, that was part of the culture I grew up in, was in some ways predominantly American culture, and it was about the idea that the future was always over the hill or on the other side of the Mississippi or in California or just kind of out west there somewhere. And when the world you were living in got sufficiently messed up, you went west to some empty land and you built yourself a new one. And that one was the future. And that was something that Europeans hadn't had. Europeans had always lived in their ruins, essentially. They were retrofitting them as they went along. And but even Europeans fell in love with the American capital F future and envied it sharply. But I think we somehow in the last half of, maybe in the last half of the previous century, we came to the end of that. We realized that we'd gone all the way to California and we'd driven into the surf. And we were going to have to be we too would have to be living in our ruins.
We yearned for space. We looked up a lot.
Yeah, we looked out, but that was, you know, that was just before the wheels hit the surf. I think that was the cultural significance of Blade Runner. It showed us an America where people had to live in the retrofitted ruins of our world.
What about cyberspace? There was a time when that was a very exciting frontier. Seemed to be.
Well, it was a frontier. It was in a quite a unique way. It was a frontier. It was like we had generated this a kind of infinite body of space in which people could do all sorts of things, and criminals and pornographers ran wild, and no one knew the better. And now it's become the place where the bank keeps your money. It's the place where the stock market actually happens, and we can't afford. You know, the laws had to come to Dodge.
Prince, the musician, says the internet is completely over. Do you agree?
Not in any literal sense. I think the internet's turned itself inside out, and we now live in it as we walk around in the world.
The law has come to Dodge. William Gibson's new book is Zero History. There's an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I think it's the third time we've talked, and I always enjoy it so much. No, our listeners do too. William Gibson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Tom, and it is always a pleasure.
Program note, on Thursday, we will look at Stephen Hawking's hot new book, The Grand Design. We will hear from Hawking himself and his Caltech co-author. I hope you'll join us then. And thank you for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.